Matt Bubala on Radio 720 WGN. So excited to be joined by documentary filmmakers Lynn Novick and Ken Burns. Their newest, Hemingway, premieres on PBS on Monday, April 5th. 2 hours over three nights each, 2 hours, 6 hours in total. I got to watch the first 2 hours, and I'm very excited about this. Thank you so much for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
Lynn, let me start with you. When you guys are coming up with an idea on a documentary you want to make, on somebody or something you want to pursue, what goes into making the decision on who are we going to find out about?
Yeah, each project has its own kind of special sauce, I guess I would say. And so in the case of Hemingway, Ken had been thinking about, I think, iconic American subjects from, you know, since the beginning of his incredible career. And I think before we ever started working together, Hemingway was on a list of projects for me. I went to Key West in the 1990s, so we're going back a long time, and visited his home and just felt, pardon me, his presence there, and have always been interested in him. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, we had other projects going on. He kind of came from the back burner to the front burner about 10 years ago, and 6 or 7 years ago, we really started in earnest.
That's amazing. Is that how this generally works? Is it's not like you guys are sitting around, hey, here's an idea, and 2 months later, we're knee-deep in it? It's a gestation process of decades?
Well, no, there's some things that you go yes to right away. You know, you're just like, we were, you know, I had said after the Civil War, we weren't going to do any more wars. It was just too wrenching, even for us, removed, you know, more than 100 years from the event. And then we decided to do World War II almost 10 years later, a little bit less. And before the ink was dry on that, we were just locking it. I said to Lynn, we're going to do Vietnam. And it was 10 and a half years after that. But we immediately started on the process. So some things take a little bit longer to sort of say yes to. It's an alchemy. There's no focus groups. There's no planning. It's what it is. And because they take so long, this one's 6 years, others, you know, a decade or more, it's not like you're planning them for a particular anniversary. We were just doing a radio interview about the Hemingway film and said it was timed for the 60th anniversary of his death. And I go, oh, it was? It is? You know, it's really just being drawn in a visceral way, kind of your heart chooses, your mind's interested, and you collect a lot more projects that your mind is digesting, but your heart decides. And I think that decision can either take a long time or it can take, you know, a very, very short time.
I imagine when you were both starting out your careers and weren't the names that you both are now, that when you were making a documentary, it had to be, that's the subject and that's my life right now. And now you have so much in the work, and the process is over an amount of time. I'm guessing you're working on various things while you're concentrating on one. Is that helpful because you get to step away a little bit?
Yeah. It's a funny sort of thing. There's a kind of big history. You know what I mean? Everything is connected. And that's a wonderful stuff. It's, you know, I started off, I did one film, and then I hated the idea that I had to sort of completely start from scratch again. So I started having two or sometimes three projects going at once. By the time Lynn came, it was that same thing. And now, you know, we have four different producing strands. Lynn is one of those strands, producing and directing, in her case, but we're working on 9 projects, if you count Hemingway. And all of them are, with the exception of maybe one, are really legitimately underway. Film's been exposed, scripts are being written, voices have been recorded, you know, all of the stuff necessary to do that. But there's a synergy that takes place. And it isn't just, I'm doing a film on Benjamin Franklin, which I am, not with Lynn, and I'm doing a film on the American Revolution, also a part. There's some synergies there, and there are, but there are connections between Benjamin Franklin and a film I'm finishing with another group that'll be out in September on Muhammad Ali.
Wow.
And it's there. And it's not kind of making scoring points in the present. It's just understanding that human nature remains the same, and there's a complex web of interrelationship and a kind of timelessness to many of the themes that are kicked up in the course of trying to ask this impossible question, or impossible to answer fully, who is Ernest Hemingway?
I want to talk more, of course, about Hemingway, but I'm so fascinated by the process that you go through. I imagine you have a list of 1,000 things that you would make documentaries on if you could. So how do you distill that down? Do you sit in a room and say, okay, do they meet this criteria? Are they really eligible? It's almost like a Hall of Fame induction. Are they going to get the treatment? Are we giving them this test of time that will live on for the next 100 or more years?
No. No, just no metrics in that regard, like the no focus groups. It's just literally us feeling it and just saying yes, looking at each other and going, yep, let's do that.
I mean, we do meet every so often, what, 3 or 4 years, and sort of the senior team of all the producing strands that Ken was talking about with our writer, Jeff Ward, who writes many of the projects, but not all. And we each come armed with ideas and then we toss them around and we sort of field test just for ourselves, though. And some of those projects might come up again every few years and we sort of, something has shifted and we say, yes, we want to do this one right now.
So I can just tell you, maybe more interesting. I mean, we've got all these great projects on Ali and LBJ and the Great Society that Lynn and I are working on. Lynn's got her own project on the history of crime and punishment. I'm doing the revolution, as I said. We're doing a film on the buffalo, the biography of a buffalo. We're doing African-American life from the Civil War to the Great Migration. I mean, lots of different really wonderful things. But it may be more interesting to you to tell you that there are 4 or 5 projects that are just hovering outside and have been for a long time on Winston Churchill, on the Marshall Plan, right? There's been Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's been on that list since the early 80s. I mean, so there are things that hover, and I can't say that we don't like them. We love them. They haven't just reached a place where we can look at each other wordlessly, without criteria, not like the Hall of Fame. You got to have so many hits and a batting average this high and sustain it for this long. It's just yes. And it's like, how do you choose your friends? That it happens, right? It just happens.
So I'm guessing you guys won't be like Hemingway at the end. There won't be all these unfinished documentaries in a vault or partially finished that we have to finish.
Yes. Oh, no, not in that regard. We will. I mean, you know, if we were given 1,000 years to live, we wouldn't run out of topics in American history. So that's a given. So there'll be lots of stuff that we won't be able to get to. And we hope that some of the people that we're bringing along will get to them for us. But no, I hope that we're not leaving anything unfinished. We've been lucky so far not to have that happen.
Well, let's talk about Hemingway. The documentary premieres April 5th on PBS, 3 nights, 2 hours each night. How, you know, you've had some that are 18 hours long, you have some that are shorter. Does the determination of how much ends up being there just end up being determined by the figure and what you have and what you can find?
Yes, but we always try to start at the beginning with an estimate of how long the film will be for budgeting and schedule and every other purpose. But most of the films that Ken and I have worked on have ended up being a little bit longer than we originally projected. And that really has to do with the process of discovery. So, you know, okay, let's try to make this a two-part biography. But Jeff Ward, our wonderful writer, came to us when he was working on the script and said, I really think this is going to have to be 3 parts. And I remember sort of thinking, gulp, really? But once we read his script, it made perfect sense. And, you know, part of his vision was to structure the film around Hemingway's relationships with the 4 women that he was married to and give his life a structure that way. And that lent itself to this 3-part series. And we had, you know, the hard part for us is the subtraction. So
sure,
it's 6 hours, but it could have been 10. And that would have been too long.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just start whittling away and refining and distilling down to what we hope is the right length in the end.
Is that the toughest part when you have 10, what you think are really good hours, and now it's got to be 6?
So I'm looking at the storyboards just off to my side here for the Benjamin Franklin film. And the first assembly that we had without pictures, just to listen to it almost like a radio play, the first episode, I think it was like 3 hours. That's not uncommon for something you're going to cut down. The second one was like 6 hours. And did that mean that it is going to become 3 episodes or 4 episodes? Uh-uh. It's 2. And in one pass with these long knives, it went down to under 2 in both cases and has stayed there hovering in a place where we're actually able to say, boy, that's an interesting thing. Maybe we can add that back in, something we took out, right? Or, you know what? This is extraneous or redundant. Let's take this out, and that'll leave room to be able to go in that little tangent that we wanted to do. Other cases like Muhammad Ali, like the Ernest Hemingway film, which was going to be 2, and then it was like 3? What? No. Yeah. Yes. Ali was supposed to be 3 and is 4. And it's because of the unbelievable amount of material, but we're not, that doesn't mean anything. It has to have a kind of structural shape and form and be natural to that expansion. Just like our baseball series expanded, our Vietnam started off kind of theoretically 7, was 8 before we really got out of the starting gates, and is 10.
For both of you, is that also just, you mentioned that knowing who to cover is kind of a gut feeling, like we know it. Is the cutting, you make it sound like, oh, these two long knives, I got it, no problem. I imagine that is more of a wrenching process. And I guess, how do you know? Is there a confidence that comes with the catalog that you've had and the success that you've been able to have to know that, hey, these are the right things to do?
I hope we're getting better as filmmakers, but I think each one is really complicated. Lynn, I think, would agree that what you take out is obeying kind of laws of storytelling. Others are obeying the internal laws and structures, deficiencies and strengths of that particular topic. It has to do with all the constituent parts that we have and who's talking on camera and who's not. All of these kind of contribute to decisions that you make. There's not a cookie cutter thing, about it.
We argue in the most collaborative and, you know, energizing way about every decision with Ken and me and Sarah Botstein, our producer, Jeff Ward, our writer, our editors. Everyone has their favorite moments and scenes that end up on the cutting room floor for a variety of reasons. And that's part of the process. And what the best thing is, when the film is done, you look back and you really don't miss those things. You know that they're gone for a reason. But you can't necessarily see that when you're in the middle of it. So it gets very impassioned in a really good way, because we really, you know, we all care so deeply about getting the story right. And, you know, with Hemingway, this film, we could have done a whole hour on A Farewell to Arms, which I think is his masterpiece. A whole hour. You wouldn't have been bored, but you would have been. You know what I mean? So trying to find just the right way to compress the story, both his life and his works, so that the audience is carried along seamlessly from one scene to the next, from one episode to the next, not feeling bored, wanting to know more, you know, an ear for the next scene. And that is a very subtle, intuitive process that you just have to be in, and then you kind of know when you've got it right.
Well, I don't believe that you two ever would have made us bored with anything, but I imagine if it was just A Farewell to Arms, we would have said, but what about, but what about, but what about, and there'd be so much left unsaid, right?
You know, man, it's less that. Lynn is absolutely right. We could have done an hour at that time, but it would have meant that something afterwards would have begun to suffer.
Right.
And we've had that time and again where sometimes the scene works really well, but something's destabilized way down the line. Mm. And so what you realize after you try to work way down the line, and you go, wait, but this is all making sense down here. What is it? And then you have to go back and sometimes examine the very best thing in a film. And I've had that happen. In fact, our other writer, Dayton Duncan, and I disagreed for 6 or 7 months, not a single harsh word. Every time he was anguished about a scene I took out, which was fabulous, but it slowed stuff down way. We took out this 5-minute scene and everything ran smoothly. And then he'd look anguished and I put it back in. And over 6 months, I gradually got him to understand it's a DVD extra, which he would, if he were here, he'd say it's a DVD extra, meaning
I got to have it, and
the wound still hurts, you know, for that.
It sounds a little bit like Hemingway himself in your documentary. He talks about how his contemporaries are writing novels and he's still struggling with paragraphs. And in your sense, you might have these great paragraphs, but they don't make sense for the whole story the whole time.
That's correct. That's correct. And that was his big leap. And that he did it so magnificently with those first two novels, The Sun Also Rises and A Farewell to Arms. It's a stunning jump from what are already. I mean, if he didn't do anything else but his short stories, you know, and I'm not sure he would have gotten to a couple of the really great ones, but Snows of Kilimanjaro and the short Happy Life of Frances McComber, he'd be really well known.
Yeah.
But he then added 4 really pretty first-rate novels on top of that, some of them real masterpieces. It's a big thing to be able to make that kind of graduation. But one of the things we were drawn to Hemingway was that his discipline, his writer's discipline, was really appealing to us. He wasn't going to let it go until it was good. It's how we feel. We wish we were as good as Hemingway, but we're struggling with our own disciplines and things like that. And when we see him, where work is itself a representative of the spirit, it's so great. And because we go, that's the way we feel. That's the way we want it to be for us too.
We're speaking with filmmakers Lynn Novick and Ken Burns. The new documentary, Hemingway, premieres on PBS on April 5th. Lynn, when you are selecting somebody and you guys really start working on it, are you ever disappointed? Do you know so much about the person that the film's going to be what it is? Or do you sometimes start really, because you guys, you're not doing exposés, you're doing really good, but sometimes that contains stuff that maybe we didn't know or were disappointed to find out. Have you ever worked on one of these and said, oh man, I wish I didn't know some of this stuff now?
I mean, I think the honest answer is yes and no. You know, first of all, we don't know that much to begin with. We know enough to know it's an interesting and important story. And for myself, I had read a lot of Hemingway's fiction and I'd read a biography or two and I felt I knew him pretty well. But as it turns out, I really didn't. And so there's enormous amount of new scholarship in the last 20 years, exploring aspects of Hemingway's life and work that I certainly had no idea about. His letters have been published and are being published in this massive effort. So you have access to his inner life through his correspondence. You know, it's like eavesdropping on his phone calls, basically. You know, he wrote a lot of letters because that's how people communicated back in those days. And people saved those letters and he saved those letters. So you have access to many different moods and experiences and relationships through the letters. And so in all of that and the photographic record, you see aspects of him, his life, his work, his relationships, his attitudes that are very disturbing and very hard to deal with. And yet it just makes him more interesting and more complicated. So, you know, it's not disappointing. Of course, that makes for a great story, just, you know, on the surface. And then below, really get underneath someone's skin and really try to understand who they really are and how they tick and why they behave the way they do. And in his case, some of his behavior is really awful.
Sure.
Some of it's great. But, you know, when you're having to confront that, you should be, at least I hope we sort of, you know, end up thinking more, why? Why would he treat somebody like that? Why would he be so mean to F. Scott Fitzgerald, who helped him so much? Why was he so resentful toward his mother? Why was he the person who, having left his first wife for his ultimately second wife, blaming the woman that he had the affair with, that he's the innocent victim of this, whereas in fact, he's the actor at the center of it. You know, so who is this guy? Why does he think this way? And then out of all that, where does this incredible art come from? So we just keep on digging deeper and deeper and deeper, and it just gets more and more interesting.
And I think that's what's so important about what you guys do, because, you know, here in the present day, when we're talking about Dr. Seuss and things like that, recently at least, it's great to see the layers peeled away from the onions, because we see that we're all flawed souls and people evolve over time, and we have to make room for that.
Exactly. And I think this is what a great gift of an Ernest Hemingway does. He's so larger than life. The art is so great and the life so spectacularly dramatic, melodramatic, bad, good, that it becomes us, but it exploded. So it's possible to see our own stuff in the things that he does. And there's something liberating by getting beyond the binary, you know, of what's going on now. Everything's yes or no, on or off. Nothing works like that in life. And the liberation of being able to go in and tolerate the contradiction and not say, oh, good here. Oh, that's bad. Now he's gone. No, you've got to take, and this, he offers plenty of opportunities to have that kind of knee-jerk reaction. But the thing is to stay in it longer permits us all to grow, to have compassion, perhaps, or not, for him to be disappointed by some actions, be thrilled at the others, to understand in the course of it that there's this other thing going on, which is literature, which is in itself transcendent art, which, you know, a century after he wrote it can wake you up. You know, I keep by my bed the collected short stories.
Really?
You know, once a week or once every couple of weeks, I'll read one or two stories, and it's just it's breathtaking. And I haven't even mentioned A Sun Also Rises or A Farewell to Arms or For Whom the Bell Tolls or The Old Man and the Sea, the four great things, or the nonfiction that he wrote, Death in the Afternoon or The Green Hills of Africa. You know, stuff falls away, but there are short stories that are spectacular and complicated. And for this macho posturing guy to have a sensitivity, a curiosity about gender fluidity, about being able to put himself into the position of a woman being bullied by a man in both conversation and sexually, are unbelievable. You just can't believe in the fact that it's way back then. It sounds like it could have been written today.
Yeah, and still have trouble maybe getting through today.
And still having trouble getting through today.
It's great that we have certainly evolved in the last 5 years, and we're talking about things that we swept under the rug for a long time, and that's incredibly important. But if we didn't make room for people's human failings, you guys would be out of a job, right? Can you think of anybody that you've covered over the years where there wouldn't be some point where somebody said, well, that was the bad part, or that was the, you know, everybody has that, right?
I mean, everyone has
that. Don't you think it's dangerous to assume that people don't have that? That there are people among us who are perfect, who are, you know, one-dimensional heroic types who don't do anything complicated or wrong or whatever. I mean, that's the fairy tale. That's a fantasy. That's just not real life.
I would argue that's social media, right? That's the big failing of our time is that we see what everybody else is doing and think they have these incredible lives. And what am I doing wrong?
Yeah. And it has this inherent binary existence, right? It is ones and zeros, but it's also about doing that. I remember I was promoting a film that I made on radio about Jack Johnson, the first African-American heavyweight champion, a very complicated, deeply flawed personal life in addition to skills, you know, perhaps on the par of Muhammad Ali, and certainly an inspiration for Muhammad Ali. And I talked to two guys who were just really giving me trouble about this is not a hero. And I said, well, a hero's not. I said, well, give me an example of a hero. And he says, Charles Lindbergh. And I go,
oh, the greatest gift. Interesting choice.
The greatest gift you've ever given me. I said, you are right. He flew in 33 and a third hours from, you know, Mitchell Field to Le Bourget Airport, solo in 1927. It's one of the great accomplishments. But he was a Nazi sympathizer. He was, the lead spokesman of America First. He, had a family and a tragic kidnapping, but it turns out, come to find out, he also had at least two other wives and other families in other places and in Germany. And, this is not the narrow hero, and the silence on the other end of the telephone call was deafening, but it proves the point. Nobody's perfect. And you want to do is tell stories about people so that we can become more perfect ourselves. Nobody's going to be perfect, but you learn from this. You understand the limits, and you are awed by the great gifts that some of these people have at the same time as they have these deep, abiding, consequential flaws.
And, I love that story, Ken. I had not heard it. It's so great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Totally. But what's interesting is that this is exactly what Hemingway is interested in.
Right.
His heroes are all flawed in his fiction. This is what he's addressing is, what is a hero? What is courage? What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a human being in a modern world that is, amoral and dehumanizing and all these things? So he went through World War I. And he's immediately questioning the notions of patriotism, courage, bravery, sacrifice, and his thinking evolves to some degree, but all of his heroes are complicated and he's equally complicated. So, that's just right in the sort of the main arc or whatever, main vein that he's mining, if that's a...
No, that's exactly right. So that you have this guy who's built this huge and permitted to be built, this macho image of him. But if he's not conscious of it, how could he possibly write Hills Like White Elephants, which is about a man bullying a woman, telling her he's not bullying her, that it's her decision. About an unspoken procedure that he wants her to have. She's not sure and is talking about it. And every woman on earth knows what it's like for an overbearing man to say, oh, no, it's whatever you want. But, without saying it, this is what I want. And then finally, the woman character finally says, will you please, please, please? It's like nine pleases in a row. Be quiet. And it is just, no toxic masculine guy that was only that, suitable for canceling could have possibly written that. And so Lynn's right. He is looking at human behavior and he's seeing it from all these sides. And he understands in the most withering self-criticism that he comes up short in every accounting. He himself is a person. As a writer, he's pretty proud of the writing he does, but he also begins to suspect that the more proud he is of his writing, the less good the writing is. So even that gets complicated. It's just, I mean, if everything's just a binary thing, you've lost all the subtleties of life. No wine tastes, has any body to it. No food has dimension. No relationship has architecture. Nothing can happen if it's just, as you say, where you there are no consequences because it's a person you don't really know.
I'm sure every artist draws immensely from their life, and Hemingway talks in your documentary about learning what you're going to write about and making sure you know it. But between his mom and his dad and the war and the stint in Kansas City, it seems like, boy, those four things really shape how he is going to write and what he's going to cover throughout his life.
And nature.
Well, and that's my reference to his dad. His mom introduced him to a love of the arts. His dad introduced him to a deep love of nature. Kansas City taught him to write in his style, it seems to me. And the war really shaped what the lens he seemed to look through for a lot of his writing.
Those are the big four.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we love to go back. I mean, look, Jeff Ward, this is one of his many great gifts, is to go back to someone's early life and the nuclear family, whatever it was that they grew up in, and sort of plant those seeds and have them grow up and, you know, spin out over the course of a lifetime. And he certainly helped us to kind of frame the film around exactly what you just said.
So you've watched one of three episodes.
Right.
You've already heard about five echoes of cesarean section.
Right.
Or childbirth, or difficult childbirth, or cesarean section. In episode one, it doesn't end. Right? I mean, it's there. And there are many, many themes that you suddenly realize, as Jeff is so masterful at, and we hope that we can follow in the editing room with him, is just the ability to sort of take up those signals. Ernest Hemingway took them up.
You know,
it was driven by them.
We were mentioning the flawed life that we all lead and the persona we want people to perceive. Hemingway himself liking to play up for the crowd who he was. But his home, when I look at those photos of Oak Park back at that time, that huge house they lived in, the dad's a doctor, the mom, the teaching, they must have looked to all the neighbors across the street like this perfect little family. And then to see what really was going on is such a lesson for us all.
That's so well said. You know, we spent some time in Oak Park on our Frank Lloyd Wright film, and he became a pariah for having an affair with one of his clients and, you know, upended the whole town. And Oak Park is a very conservative, you know, Christian, just
seemingly
white, right? Seemingly, you know, Hemingway could not wait to get away from there. And that's interesting too, that he didn't want the life his parents had. But behind the closed doors of his family's house, his father was suffering from very serious depression and anxiety. And he had to go away at times, supposedly on a business trip, but actually to rest his worried soul. And the family, you know, didn't really talk about that either. So you have planted the seed of, we're not going to really talk about mental illness here, even though his father really became quite unwell.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Oak Point Park, one of his great favorite writers, as it should be everyone, is Leo Tolstoy, who's arguably the greatest novel of the 19th century, is called Anna Karenina. And it opens, happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And so you have the facade of happiness and you have the reality of the ways, the infinitely torturing ways that each family has both this nurturing aspect, but also a toxicity that can be, you know, create an Ernest Hemingway, but not without a lot of toxic byproduct.
So we talked about the big four, as Ken just called them, but the other big four would be the four marriages in Hemingway's life. And you point out in the first episode that the next one was always ready. He jumped from one to the other. And how much we talked about his mom and his dad and the style of writing and the war and how those played into so many of his themes. How much did his personal life, his marriages and his battles with love affect his writing?
You know, I feel in a way sort of ground zero for his whole life is his relationship with the nurse he fell in love with during World War One when he was recuperating from being blown up in the trenches. And he was deeply in love with her. She was an older woman. And he went back to America thinking that they were going to get married. And she sent him one of the all-time most devastating Dear John letters that I have ever seen. you know, saying that you're just a boy and I hope you have a wonderful life and career and, you know, good luck. And he was totally devastated and just completely undone, dysfunctional, unable to really do anything. And from that moment on, I think you see everything that is foretold. So
And we all see the four wives as this evidence of this masculine misogyny. And it's not, I don't think. I think it's born of a deep insecurity. And I think there's also a sense that as much as he wants his women to be, with the exception, I mean, he can tame the women he marries and be how he wants it, sexually, to be like a boy and to do the gender exploration that is part of the interesting story. But I think also to just serve him. And it also doesn't work, so he also has to get away from that. And then his third wife, Martha Gellhorn, isn't buying into any of that stuff. She is not going to become a wholly owned subsidiary of Ernest Hemingway Incorporated. And that really is disturbing to him. And so, you know, what starts out as this fireworks and passionate love affair becomes something in which he becomes almost the kid, terrified and worried. And she's out continuing her work as a writer. She's not going to check her professional life at the door, thank you very much. And that really undoes him until he finds wife number four, who is willing to subsume herself into the greater man, which is, you know, part of the flaw in his thinking.
I mean, it's so true. And yet, and I also have on some level understand that for his time and place, his expectations of what his wife would be were yes. completely in the mainstream, if not more so, you know. How many women had careers outside of the home and were equal to their husbands in terms of what they earned or where they went or what they did? I mean, it's very unusual for his social class.
But his mom, right? His mom was one of those people, right?
Yes, she was. Exactly. Paradox number one. Exactly.
And he
the mother earned more money than the father back then. A doctor didn't actually make that much money. Yeah. She was the one who brought in the real money to support this fancy house and nice life that they had.
Which is amazing. And then he ended up with such a complicated relationship with his mom. And you know, if we step back and we don't peel the layers of this onion and we just look at Hemingway, he wrote like a man. He made writing tough. Bullfights, plane crashes, shrapnel from the war. We look at like, wow, that's a man's man. But then the way he goes out, paranoid, struggling to finish his work, struggling, maybe mental illness, maybe wounds that just he carried around his whole life in his heart and in his head. And ended so tragically. And what do we take from that? I imagine, like we're talking about everything else, that life is much more complicated than we ever thought and we ever think of somebody else's life. These idyllic lives from the outside just aren't that. What do you guys take from how he ended?
I think you've said that, Matt, just as beautifully as could be said. You know, you stand at the edge of the ocean and the tide is low and you see that, you know, long expanse of relatively flat water. And if you go stand in it, it has undertow, right? And sometimes it can pull you out. And I think that we misjudge if we're only going to look at that superficial distance. We misjudge things. We don't understand how deep something might be or how much the current is flowing below the surface. And if you do that, it takes time. It takes discipline. It's 6 years. A lot of filmmakers say, what, 6 years? I've done, you know, I got to do, you know, get it done in a year and a half. And it may be the exigencies of their work. But in public broadcasting, we are given a chance to do a complete job. And then when you get there, you're raising more questions than you're answering, but you've got a really good story because it's at the one hand unique and significant in the case of Hemingway. The art is undeniable. I can't write like that. But it's also familiar in a way. That is to say, about familial relationships, the power of a mother to influence an entire life, or a father's loss to influence an entire life, to the twinning that a mother did, dressing the sisters and the brothers up as girls or boys, depending on her mood, what that does to him, what the PTSD that you get from being blown up, you know, being an 18-year-old ambulance driver in Italy. You know, all of these things, if you're willing to say this is a really complicated recipe, then you have the possibility, if you wait long enough, if you cook it right, that it rewards with delicacies of flavors that you don't get if it's just a hot dog on the grill.
We know enough to say, I couldn't write like that. But that's the trick of Hemingway, isn't it? Because when you read it, you think, I could write like that.
I could write like that, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He makes it look easy. One of the scholars in the film says he impersonates simplicity, you know, and he could write for highbrow and lowbrow and anyone, very accessible. But actually, if you, it's not that accessible. You have to read and reread and really think. And there's a lot that's not said that's so powerful. And, you know, and one of the most wonderful parts of the process was having access to his manuscripts at the JFK Library in Boston, and being able to see how he revised, you know, and rewrote and cut and removed and put a comma and took it out and changed a but to an and, you know, just carefully, carefully crafting. We couldn't do it ourselves. At least we got to appreciate what he put into it and how meticulous and sort of dedicated he was to getting it right. And look, I mean, he's the most parodied, imitated writer on earth. You know, there's contests to imitate Hemingway. It's easy to do, but to actually do it, I think only he can. And yet his influence is everywhere in literature. So I think one of the writers said, you know, either you're imitating him or trying not to imitate him. So it's, he's everywhere. Mm-hmm. Even with younger generations of writers who may not even realize it.
I wonder if it speaks a little bit to, was his style, but also saying less is maybe a man of the time or what a man thought he should be at the time, right? Probably what his dad was, not really talking about your feelings and what's really going on. And the way he was able to convey that he wasn't saying as much, but you have to read more into it. Maybe really spoke to who he was.
That's a very interesting interpretation. I don't know. I think that the critic who said it, that Lynn quoted, who dared to impersonate simplicity, was talking about the modernist movement in which the writers were famously complicated, like James Joyce and, right, and William Faulkner, and that he wasn't. He went against the grain of that. And I think, to me, the best image I can come up with is like an iceberg, you know, that you see the tip of it. And if you think that's it, you've missed what it's about, because what's unspoken, just as in music, is not the notes, it's the interval between the notes. And he got that from his mom, and he got that from Bach, and he got it from the repetition and counterpoint. And as we say, counterpoint and repetition, that's in Bach. You begin to hear a kind of rhythm, a music to his spare prose that then you begin to realize the choice of something, and that the editing that he did is so impressive, always seemingly making it simpler or rhythmic, but at the same time implying that, like that iceberg, 9/10 of it is below the surface. And that is you, my dear readers, responsibility. And that's genius. That is genius.
Hemingway premieres April 5th on PBS. Check your local listings, 3 nights in a row, 2 hours each night. It will certainly be worth our time. So before I let you guys go, now let's get a couple of questions about the future. We're talking about social media. I wonder, 50, 100 years from now, will people be making documentaries in the same way? Or are we vomiting everything in our lives out so much that there is going to be nothing to look back on that's going to be different or interesting to look at?
They worried that the printing press would destroy, you know, letters. They worried that the telegraph would destroy letter writing. You know, there's some everything changes. You use the tools that you have. What hasn't changed is human behavior and storytelling laws. So whatever the material is, we're going to be using it somehow, whether we're telepathically communicating to each other through, you know, the Apple of the future, or maybe people are going to rebel and go back to, I'm not doing anything electronic, I'm only going to write letters anymore. That's the way it is, a kind of Fahrenheit 451, where you've committed one novel to your, one great work of literature to your memory, and that you carry this as a human library, a repository. We don't know, and probably neither, and both, and whatever, but the human nature will keep producing extraordinary but complicated and deeply flawed individuals. And storytelling will require that we use the tools in which people express themselves to the best advantage.
Lynn's giving a look like, yeah, I couldn't say that better.
Yeah. So you're basically, I agree completely. I'm just trying to imagine, you know, what's it going to be like to try to make a documentary 20 years from now using whatever is available archivally to tell the story of something happening today. And, you know, we're in it. So we're living through such momentous times, and we are so much at the mercy of this media cycle. It's hard to really get any perspective. So we'll just be grateful that when time passes, we'll be able to look back and understand what actually happened. Because right now, I personally am overwhelmed. I don't know what's going on, even though I'm, you know, very much seemingly aware it's impossible. It's like, you know, you're in the middle of a hurricane and you don't see clear sky.
Well, I guess that's the important thing too, is that while I was saying everything's out there, but the truth isn't necessarily out there. It's variations and gradations on the truth, right?
But the story isn't out there. Storytelling is the editing of that overwhelming tsunami of information that besets Lynn, but also you and me. And that's true. So the beginning of storytelling is, and we feel it today that nobody's on the same page because of the proliferation of all the places that you can be. And what a story does is it puts everybody, sometimes in the case of Ernest Hemingway, literally on the same page. And so you can come at it. Doesn't matter. It doesn't, to read The Sun Also Rises doesn't require that you register in as a red state person or a blue state person or a male or a female or gay or straight or rich or poor. You get on the same page. And so storytelling becomes a way in which we can help to make some sense of the chaos that Lynn so completely described. It's impossible, particularly now with the proliferation of everything, but that's why we need storytellers.
Ken speaks a lot about this. We need truth. We need facts. We need verifiable information, and we need, you know, but the passage of time will help with that, but that's the most, I think, useful thing that documentarians can do going forward, is actually help us understand what actually happened based on facts.
Yeah.
And those are not impossible to find.
For sure. I was looking at a list of upcoming projects, and I don't know how factual this was or not. I know that you have a bunch of stuff on the docket. I don't know which you two are working together on, but I saw the name Barack Obama. Is that true? Is that in the plans?
That would be a great subject to do. I don't know. I mean, I hope so. I would love to do it.
I was just curious because everything else is generally pretty far from the past, and this would be...
A few films are Lynn and my update of baseball called The 10th Inning. The Central Park Five have been that. And so you'd want some passage of time, which I think in our world today, you know, if you have, 4 years of Donald Trump feels like, you know, 12 ordinary years. So you're already, you know, almost to that cutoff point. So I think if you wait a while, but Lynn and I are working on a history of the United States and the Holocaust, what we knew and when we knew it, what we did and what we didn't do and what we perhaps should have done, a very complicated tale. We're also working on a history of LBJ and the Great Society, a kind of reverse angle view of LBJ from our Vietnam film, a person ill-equipped and tragically inclined to blunder after blunder with regard to and lie after lie with regard to the Vietnam War, but someone committed to a domestic agenda that still influences us today, including the creation of public broadcasting, of which Lynn and I have spent our entire professional lives, working with great pleasure. So, it's a pretty interesting story that we'll be focusing on what his idea of the Second New Deal was. He called the Great Society, and some of it's being dismantled, some of it's being reassembled today. Yeah. It's stay tuned.
You know that you brought up PBS a couple of times, and I'm sure they thank you so much, and I want to thank you both very much on behalf of the viewing public, because you've. Documentaries will always be around. There are millions of great documentary filmmakers, but you guys have been able to put a face on things like very few others have and bring attention to the form. So thank you for that. However, a guy just pulled up in a limo. It's probably 10 years ago now. I guess it would have to be from Warner Brothers with two suitcases full of cash. He's got $150 million for you. Here's your budget. What are you guys making?
We're staying with public broadcasting. I'll tell you why. We could have, our Vietnam and another film that I worked at, not with Lynn, on the history of country music, both cost about $30 million, which is the biggest budgets we've had by far. It took forever to raise the money, and you're looking at one of the chief fundraisers, and I spend way too much time like a congressman with my tin cup out.
Kissing babies.
But I'll tell you, I could have walked into a premium, cable company or a streaming service at the beginning and said this, and they go, oh, with your record? Absolutely. Sure. Here it is. $30 million. Now you'll have it done in 2 years. And we're going, no, it'll be 10. And that's to us the deal breaker.
Yeah.
At some point you want to be able to say, we're proud of this work, and it requires time and attention and diligence. If you want a ticky-tacky house, I know a construction company that can put it up. But if you want something that's solid, that architecture takes time. That construction takes a lot of time.
And on top of that, the Warner Brothers or whoever is coming is going to want final control of the film. So that's an incredibly important thing. They would be basically saying, here's where act one ends. Here's where act two begins. Here's what, you know, we have the creative decision-making right. for the films that we do. And PBS, you know, doesn't make those choices for us. And that's, there's no price tag you can put on that.
None.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're very much looking forward to seeing it all. Hemingway on PBS starting on April 5th, three nights in a row, 2 hours each night. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you.
Been fun.